There can't be a causal connection between being induced somehow to pay out more money by something that happened after that occurs. If there's no further questions,
thank you, counsel. We'll hear rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. A few quick things. First, on the accrual time, I would point out that the district court's order is absurd because at the time that the plaintiff paid the money, the $8,000 for the features, he didn't know whether the statements that the car would one day become self-driving were false or not. So to say that the injury occurred on that date doesn't make sense because there was no misleading statement at that time, or at least you didn't know what the statements, you don't know that whether it's misleading until some future time. Second, on the discovery rule presumes that all elements of the claim have been met, and then the question is whether the plaintiff discovered the problem or should have discovered the problem. But in our case, that's not what we're saying. We're saying that all of the elements are not met, at least not at the time of purchase. The question we're asking is when do all of the elements become met? So we're not presuming initially that they're all met and then asking when should the plaintiff have discovered it.
The complaint alleges that he purchased the car on December 31st, 2016. He paid $8,000 for the FSDC package. There's a representation in January of 2016 and up to that point where this self-driving car would be available within 2 years at maximum. Why didn't he bring his claim in 2018? When that, if the claim is that the promise to purchase this was based on misrepresentations that it would be available before he paid the money, why not bring the case in 2018? Why wait 6 years? See, that's the...
Right. So
at the thing we're struggling with.
Right. So at the time the plaintiff purchased the car, Tesla repeated promises about making the car self-driving, but the Tesla did not provide any particular date. It said that it's going to, you know, it's going to have.
Thought the January 2016 statement was 2 years, and then there was a subsequent statement of within a year.
Right, but he purchased the car on December 31st, 2016. On December 31st, 2016, Tesla made statements such as the statement about the smart summoning. He would be able to summon the car from anywhere, and he would be able to get in the car, and it would drive him anywhere. Those statements were not dated. So I think a fact question arises as to whether, you know, a reasonable consumer would just look at the January statement, or instead they would look at the statement that was actually made at the time of purchase that he relied on when he purchased the car.
Well, but the January statement put a two-year mark on it. Did have a two-year mark.
Right, but the more recent statement that happened on the day of purchase conflicts that statement, or at least it doesn't confirm it because it doesn't include a date. I think I might have exceeded the time. I had some other points, but given that I'm out of time, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both. We'll take the case under advisement. The next argument will be in case number 24775, Joseph versus United States.
I think every court should have one of these podiums. Just saying.
Good
morning, and may it please the court. I'm Denise Rubin. My firm is Rubin Law, PLLC, and I appear as appellate counsel to the office of Alan Ripka and Associates. As the court is no doubt aware, this is a relatively straightforward summary judgment motion. And the record shows that there are material questions of fact that remain unanswered that needed to be resolved, if only by a Travers hearing where we could have adduced the evidence to clearly flesh out whether proper service was made and whether, in fact, this process server was pushed off to the side in the sense that he was not allowed to proceed upstairs to the attorney, U.S. Attorney's office because of the COVID epidemic. He was stopped in the lobby and a special security officer.
Sorry, but that was in the U.S. Attorney's office, right? So going upstairs wasn't going to get him to the Postal Service where he needed to be.
Understood, Judge, but he didn't know that yet. He didn't know that at all.
Why is it relevant at all?
It's relevant because the security officer took his papers, said she was authorized to take his papers, stamped the papers and gave them back, you know, a copy of the papers, and gave them back to him. He had no reason standing there with the stamped papers in his hand to think he'd gone to the wrong place.
Am I right that we don't have copies of those stamped papers and signed papers in the record?
No, we don't.
Yes. Yeah, because we have the opposing affidavits. What's concerned me is that you didn't have a chance to file a surreply to, and that would have maybe responded to the affidavits that were submitted by the government. But I see no basis. I've seen nothing that suggested that you had anything that would have actually created an issue of fact as to whether proper service was actually made. So can you tell me what you might adduce if we were to remand this?
Well, one, they continue to argue that they had no such employee as a person named S. Pilna. The affidavit of service says she refused to give her full name. He writes S. Pilna, which was probably on a badge somewhere. And her name is Pilnacek. We know from Mr. Slater's declaration as her supervisor that there is a Dolores Pilnacek working as a special security officer at that time and at that place. And that
again, in the U.S. Attorney's office, though, not at the post office. So what do you have to suggest that service was actually made on the Postal Service?
Well, the question, I think, is whether he was dissuaded from going further. Had she said to him, oh, no, these are for the post office, that's not us, he would have gone next door. But she took the papers, she looked at them, she stamped them, and she handed the stamp copy back. He had no reason to think that he was in the wrong place. And to,
I guess even if all of that is true, it's not disputed that the papers were not received by the Postal Service. So the process service affidavit goes to the delivery efforts. But
well,
on the other side, there's no issue, it seems to me.
Respectfully, Judge, we disagree because there is an affidavit, a declaration from a Ms. Herbst in St. Louis who says we have these papers, they're stamped with the date the 17th. We don't know what the process is. Are they stamped the minute they're arriving, or do they sit in a pile for a day or two till the envelope is open and then stamped? A Traverse hearing, again, would have adduced this information, so we would have had an opportunity to say, oh, no, look, they got it that day by mail.
But counsel, part of the problem is that the affidavit also says there are separate entrances, that the post office has its own entrance, and the U.S. Attorney's Office has its own entrance. And it would not be atypical for somebody the front line of an office to accept papers. They don't sit there. They're not lawyers. They don't sit there and read them and say, hey, are we the proper office to receive it? The burden and the onus is on the person serving to get the right place. So if you go to the wrong house and they accept the papers, somebody at the front door accepts them, does that mean that you've perfected service when there's a completely separate entrance? So the process server should have gone to the right house and there were separate entrances. So I don't know how that really helps you, whether
again,
it was S. Pilna or S. Pilnacek.
Well, S. Pilna, it's Dolores, actually Dolores Pilnacek, then puts in an affidavit where she doesn't address any of this. She does not tell us, oh, we keep records so I can see that I didn't take papers from him on that day, or my custom and practice would have been to say, oh, no, you're in the wrong place, if it said post office on it, or a deposition of whoever would have been met at the front of the office of the U.S. attorney had he been allowed to proceed upstairs would have said either, no, we would have taken them without reading, we wouldn't have told them otherwise, or perhaps had he come to us with these papers, we would have said, no, 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 you need to go downstairs and next door. The problem is we don't know, and the record doesn't know, because they were denied the Traverse hearing that they sought.
So ultimately, you'd want to end up with a kind of service by estoppel notion, that if you could show that he was misled, either on purpose or through some sloppiness, that the government should treat service as having been made and the service received by the Postal Service.
Not exactly, Judge. Close, but more to the point that the government and the people working at the security desk for the government should not be misleading a process server, should not be taking those papers, stamping them, and saying, I'm authorized to take papers.
But ultimately, where you'd be going, you still wouldn't have service being timely made on the agency as required by statute. So you'd have to be arguing that we should understand it to have been made, right?
Had he not been misled, had he not been allowed to leave those papers, he would have gone next door and served the post office physically. But when a security guard says, I can't let you go upstairs, I can take those papers for you, and stamps them and gives them back to him. And I recognize the stamped copies are not here on the record, but there's also no evidence and not even an allegation that that didn't happen from the other side. So we have to assume, taking the evidence in the light most favorable to the opponent of a summary judgment motion, as the court was bound to do, that there was no such evidence. In any case, the Traverse hearing would not have been an undue burden. It would not have taken years of litigation to resolve. And at that point, we would have had clear answers, because the case law here says that when you're opposing good service, you have an obligation to say exactly what happened, what my process is, this is what I recall. Ms. Pilnicek's affidavit, her declaration, is silent. She says, this is what I do in general, but she doesn't say, I have a recollection of this person, I keep a log of all papers left with us. She simply does not meet the burden that the case law sets for them. Thank you.
We'll hear from the government.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court, Philip DePaul, Assistant U.S. Attorney, representing the government in this case. I think it's important to start by reorienting where we are. The case law is clear, and this court made it essentially emphatically clear in Cook that actual receipt by the agency is what is required. I know there's been a lot of discussion this morning about service. When we're operating under the FTCA, actual receipt by the appropriate agency is what is required. And respectfully, plaintiffs did not meet their burden to show that below. They did not show that they properly served a post office location or a Postal Service employee. My friend on the other side stated that the process server below had no reason to believe they were not in the right place. Respectfully, there was every reason to believe that the process server was in the wrong place. On the front of the door of the U.S. Attorney's Office, it says in big, bold letters, U.S. Attorney's Office. And underneath that, it says the words post office with an arrow pointing to the right, to the next door. When he walked in, there is no indicia of it being a post office. No mail slots, no mailboxes, no teller windows, nothing. So I think really the question is whether it was reasonable for that individual to believe he was in a post office at the time, and whether it was reasonable for him to believe that he was effectuating service on the post office. And there was really no reason for him to believe that. And Your Honors, we're talking about a licensed process server with instructions from counsel to serve the Postal Service. If he walks into a door that says, this is not the post office, with no indicia that it is a post office, then he's not serving the post office. With respect to the allegation that there should have been a Traverse hearing below, again, I think the point of a Traverse hearing is to determine whether service was properly effected. And when we're operating under the FTCA, it's a different standard. It's whether the appropriate agency actually received the administrative claims. And I think the record makes clear that they did not serve a Postal Service location. Again, no indicia that's a Postal Service, no mailboxes, no sign that says it is a post office. In fact, there's a sign that said it's not a post office. And then there's no reason to believe that the person they were serving was a Postal Service employee. There's evidence in the record that says Ms. Pilnicek was not a Postal Service employee, had never worked for the post office, was never authorized to accept.
So why isn't there a genuine issue of material fact, at least about how that unfolded? You know, if this security officer did tell this process server that she was authorized to accept service on behalf of the Postal Service, would that create a relevant genuine issue of material fact?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because I think the question really is whether it was reasonable for their licensed process server to believe that they were serving a post office. So they're in a place that has no indicia of it being a post office. And then if someone says to them that I can accept papers, like objective circumstances would allow that person to believe they were actually serving a post office. Like, so for example, if I'm a process server and I walk into a Starbucks attempting to serve the Postal Service and there's nothing in there that says that I'm in a post office, I'm rather in a Starbucks where it's serving coffee, I don't think it would be reasonable for anyone to infer that I was serving the post office. So I think there really is no genuine issue of material fact there. I think the court below correctly held that they did not prove, which was, again, their burden to show that they served a Postal Service location and a Postal Service employee.
Your opponent mentioned that there is documentation that the Postal Service received the notice, and it's dated November 17th. I don't know if that's alluding to the standard form 95S or something else. Can you tell us your position on that?
Yes, those are the standard form SF-95s that were mailed to the post office. So there were three attempts at service here, Your Honor. Only one of them actually made it to the post office, and those are the SF-95s that are in the record at 851 and 855. Those are the mailed claims that were stamped as received on November 17th, 2021.
Because the November 16th, which I think is interesting, if you think you served the right person on November 15th, why would you attempt service on November 16th? Following day on a post office, what is believed to be a post office, but allegedly the claim is that a document was left at 86 Chambers Street, which actually houses the Civil Division of the U.S. Attorney's Office and not a post office. So it seems odd that there would be but perhaps this is a better question for your opponent, is if you think service was perfected or done adequately on November 15th, why try again on November 16th?
I agree, Your Honor, and I will say with respect to the two other methods of service, those weren't raised on appeal, so those really have been waived. But I will note that there's evidence in the record regarding the service at 86 Chambers, which is not undisputedly not a post office. No one's arguing that it is. And even in the process service affidavit for the service on 86 Chambers, it says authorized to accept. They didn't dispute below that it wasn't a post office. So there's clearly no one at 86 Chambers saying that they're authorized to accept your service for the Postal Service. And Your Honors, if you have no further questions, we'll stand on our papers and respectfully request that the court affirm.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear rebuttal.
In answer to the question a few minutes ago, the reason they would then serve on the 16th and mail the copies to St. Louis directly, I think partly were because there was some question in the sense that he wasn't allowed to proceed upstairs. So we don't know that the people upstairs ever got it. We don't. And again, I would say to the court, we don't know what they would have said had he been allowed to go up there.
Okay, so let's assume there was a question. The statute of limit, it has to be served by the 16th, why not make sure you're at a post office the next day? Like, you would think that would be the moment that you'd want to ensure that service was done on the correct agency.
I think there's also, in answer to your question, I think there's also some confusion, and I'm not sure whose confusion this was, but the declaration by Ms. Herbst at A48 says that she is the with the National Tort Center St. Louis General Law Office. And Mr. Powell's affidavit states that I served upon the United States Postal Service care of the Chief Counsel Torts General Law Service Center, which he then calls the USPS. I think perhaps the terminology was somehow not clear to him. He thought that he was going to the U.S. Attorney's Office and was not clear and was not made clear to him that there's a difference between serving us here and going next door to the post office. This is just, again, surmise on my part, but looking at the titles. I mean, the question that we have, again, is what would we have learned had we had the opportunity to depose SSO Pilnicek, to depose whoever would have been on duty at the front desk of the U.S. Attorney's Office on that day? What is your custom and practice? Somebody comes to you with this addressed, this title on the papers. Would you have just accepted them, or would you have turned him away and said you're in the wrong place? It is not appropriate for the government to be taking a position that if we don't tell somebody they're in the wrong place while they're still standing there and have an opportunity to fix it, not to say this is where you have to go, but even just to say this is not the right place. But that never happened. And when somebody takes the papers and stamps them and says, I'm authorized to take service, at that point, a reasonable person would say, okay, I served them properly. They took the papers. She's authorized.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you both. We'll take the case under advisement.